Welcome to the worlds of WordCraft. Welcome to the worlds of WordCraft. Welcome to the worlds of WordCraft.
Welcome to the worlds of WordCraft. English 115F, Fall 2007, Vanderbilt University. Professor Jay Clayton, Professor Matthew Jed Hall. Visit our class blog at worldsofwordcraft.wordpress.com.
So let this, you know, let this be a learning experience about online games, that sometimes the server can go down, sometimes you cannot have the assistance you need. Unexpected things can happen. So if you need to accomplish something, you ought to do it ahead of time, right?
That's right.
So for today, I wanted to do two things. First of all, I wanted us to talk about the Borges story that we read for today, and also in the second part of the period, I wanted us to talk about the role of means of characterization in the film Lord of the Rings. Eventually we'll be talking about, and in fact today even we'll be talking about, implicit contrast with both the novel and the game. But first let's talk about the reading by Borges. Reactions?
It was crazy.
The
beginning was really confusing.
It was I thought it was really cool because it like foreshadowed the internet, it seemed like to me.
Right.
Because it was written in like 40 something, right? 1940.
Exactly.
So I thought that was bizarre because when I read it, I thought it was a really modern reading, but it wasn't at all.
How do you think it foreshadowed the internet?
Because it was talking about like this vast array of, or like this endless array of all the knowledge in the universe and everything that has ever, every book that has ever existed is in there, but they can't ever find it because it's just jumbled in with all this nonsense. And that's a lot of like the internet. Like there's a lot of good information on the internet, but there's a lot more like just junk. So that's what I saw.
I'm gonna get it up on the screen over there shortly. Other reactions.
I don't know. I've read some other Borges, and it didn't. It was a little bit different.
What else have you read by Borges?
All that one about the wedding where everyone grows up because they eat the cake. He does a lot of magical realism.
Uh-huh.
You know what I'm talking about. He does a lot of magical realism, and this seemed more like fantasy.
So, really, one of the first questions you want to be thinking about in relation to this short story is what it is, what genre it is. So, either pull it up on your computer or look at it on this screen, but let's not be playing the game while we're talking here. Yes, Mike.
You asked what genre it is. It almost seemed like a fable or like a mythology of sorts.
Uh-huh.
In that, I thought those are usually characterized by like trying to explain the universe or the origin of life or something like that. And that's kind of what this was, because this is, it even says in the beginning that this is, that others call the library the universe. So, I mean, he wasn't too subtle about that.
Other reactions? Comments? Mike's carrying the day here.
I definitely agree.
I just liked it when he started talking about the religious, I thought he was alluding to religion and religious people who were just like presupposing, trying to write what they thought the truths of the world were, and obviously they were just like guessing blindly because they didn't know what the actual information in the library would have said. They were just pulling it out of there.
I like when he was talking about all the different methods that people were trying to find the main rule of the library, finding a book to lead book A to lead to book B to C, and all the different theories, how MCV was it, added up to different values. Mm-hmm. Everybody was trying to find the truth, and then some people just thought there weren't any.
So lots of questing for truth in stories about linguistics, It's about a virtual universe, as Mike started us off with. Greg said he liked the allegory about the religion. In a sense, this story is allegorical. I think he had his hand up first. Wesley, go ahead.
Actually, I think...
Wesley, go ahead.
I thought it was very interesting and accurate in how it portrayed our... the humankind's search for knowledge.
Right.
How we think one thing leads to another thing, but then we actually, the more we find out, the more we find out we don't know. It's like the more we discover, the more we realize how little we didn't know, and the more we thought that there was order, the less they realized they actually knew about that order. And I thought it was very accurate in his depiction of how we think we can, you know, figure out this whole universe, this whole library that we're in, but we really can't.
Excellent. So we've got an allegory of religion or belief systems. We've got an allegory of knowledge. We've got an allegory of the quest.
Yes.
We've got a prophecy of the internet.
Yes.
I like all those except for the internet bit because it says it had always been. But anyway, I didn't get the last paragraph where he says how it's infinite, and then he goes back and says that if an eternal traveler were to walk, he would find the same disorder and then make it the order, you know? But
here's the last paragraph. Show where...
He says...
Which read to us the passage.
Well, he says in the last sentence of the paragraph before, the second half of the last sentence, but the library will endure... illuminated, solitary, infinite, and then he says, I've just written the word infinite, and he says that he does believe, and it's okay to believe that the world is infinite, and those who say that it's not, that's absurd. But then he goes on to say that if an eternal traveler were to cross it in any direction, after centuries he would see that the same volumes were repeated in the same disorder. So wouldn't that make it not infinite? I know that he says that technically it has a limit because there are only so many arrangements of the letters. I don't know, that part was kind of confusing.
He said it's cyclical also.
Yeah. Yeah, I was going to say, to add to your confusion, he says his solution to the ancient problem is the library is unlimited and cyclical, which I don't really understand how that's possible, because I guess if you go in a circle long enough, you can keep going, and that's it's unlimited.
And that's a definition of infinity, as was the one that was repeated in italics, a circle whose center is everywhere and circumference is nowhere, is a very famous metaphysical definition of infinity. So there's all kinds of play with the question of whether it's infinite or not. And you're right to ask or propose that he's contradicting himself in relation to the question of the infinity of the universe. Michael?
I thought it was interesting that they had, professional questers?
Yes.
The official searchers, inquisitors, and they were, they were always extremely tired from their journeys and spoke of, the broken stairways, which almost killed them. Talk with librarian of galleries and stairs. And they're still questing when they get back. They pick up the nearest volume and leap through it, looking for infamous words. But the difference between that, the questing we've been reading about in this, is that here it says no one expects to discover anything. They're just questing,
Interesting. So,
with no purpose.
The quests in the game and in the books that we've been reading, the movies we've been watching, seem to have more of a goal. Even though each of our theorists have said that when you get to the end, it's just the beginning of a new quest.
Yeah.
You think there's a qualitative difference between how futile and meaningless the quests are in the Library of Babel as opposed to the books we've been reading.
I suppose.
Yes. Other comments? Yes, sir, Seth.
I just thought you got me very excited for some reason, because probably back to my sci-fi days and all this backstory and stuff. I love reading the footnotes. Now we would go further on like societies they formed or chieftains.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just interested in all kind of wars they had and purges. And I want to know all this backstory. I really wasn't thinking of it more in a internet form. I was just thinking about
how finite. I was trying to actually try to figure out how many possible rooms there were, but I can't figure out the combination, the formula for it. I know it's near infinite, but I just think it's fascinating. And like the whole cylindrical form of the universe reminds me just right now of the concept of the universe and how there's really no end. It curves in upon itself, and that's like that's a scientific theory now about just how our universe is formed.
So let me just tell you a bit about this story. This is written by Jorge Luis Borges. He died in 1986. He lived a long and very prolific life. He was an Argentinian writer who became famous early in his life. He was born in Buenos Aires. He grew up speaking both Spanish and English from birth. His father was had a great library that was full of Greek myths and of the English Romantic poets, particularly Shelley and Keats were some of his favorites. And Borges was precocious. He translated Oscar Wilde into Spanish at the age of 9. Very impressive. In World War I, he and his parents were marooned in Europe, and so he went to university at the University of in Switzerland. All of a sudden, I'm blanking.
This is Collège de Genève.
Okay, good. Where he studied French and Latin, and he published his first poetry at age 20. And then he began writing these short stories in the 30s. 1935, I think, he published his first short story. But the stories he became known for were the kind of paradoxical oddities that resemble this one. The first of those stories that brought him fame, he published in 1939. It was called Pierre Menard, Author of Don Quixote. Anybody by any chance read that in a Spanish class or
Don Quixote?
Have you read that?
Yes.
Yeah, excellent. Glad to hear that. Was Pierre Menard the author of Don Quixote?
No,
it was Cervantes. Yeah. So this was a story, a little parable about a guy in the 20th century named Pierre Menard who was rewriting Don Quixote by copying it out longhand, word for word. And he says, and was publishing it, saying it's an entirely new work because Cervantes wrote it, and the original, and I'm writing the copy of the original. And so that's a different text that, because I know that I'm copying it, I've made it anew. So it was just a little intellectual curiosity, just like this short story is. So this is very much an intellectual curiosity, this piece. It doesn't really have characters. Does it have characters? Is there a character?
The narrator.
And what do you learn about the narrator as a character? We're getting ready to talk about characters, so let's see. First of all, it's got a character. What do we learn about it? Yes, sir.
Didn't he say that he was dying?
Yeah.
He's near age. He's writing in old age. Seth?
He knows a lot of the history of the library.
He knows as much as a mortal.
Let me add one thing here. It says in 1937, he was working in the Buenos Aires Municipal Library.
Yes, indeed. That's right. Borges himself spent most of his life as a librarian until, sadly, in the 60s, or late 50s, actually, he developed glaucoma and went blind. And so when I heard him speak, I was an undergraduate. He came to the U.S. and spoke, and it was... By this time, he was one of the most celebrated writers in the world, and the scene was mobbed. It was like the Salman Rushdie ticket that we had here last week. And he was completely blind, and it had been for decades at that time. But he continued to write, and he continued to listen to literature that was read to him. And this man who worked in a library and lived in a library as an employee had the heartbreak of being blind. What about the character? Anything more we can say about the narrator?
Well,
he used to be an adventurer. He mentioned that one point that for many years he searched throughout the library for all sorts of things.
So he'd gone on his quest.
Yes, thanks.
You hear a little bit about his father, too. And his father found some book, the MCB book, so I guess he maybe was an explorer, adventurer, too.
That's right. So that questing and spirit. But this is this is little enough to know about the only character in a short story. I mean, would you even call this a short story?
I don't know what I'd call it.
What?
I don't know what I'd call it.
No, that's exactly right.
When I read it, when I clicked on the hyperlink, I thought it was just describing the actual article. And then when I looked it up online, it was the same thing. And I thought, oh, crap, I don't know what I'm doing.
That's a setting.
Pardon me?
It's a setting.
Let me ask a question. Did everyone read it? Who read it, Ray Jane? I just want to make sure we have the pulse.
No, everybody's with us here.
100%.
Yeah. What did you say?
Because it's a setting.
It's a setting. Well, remember, when we started talking about virtual worlds and started giving characteristics of a virtual world, did we begin with character? No, we began talking about setting. Because that's one thing virtual worlds are good at. Is creating a sense of place. And part of this is just a vast metaphysical conceit about a setting that mirrors the universe or mirrors certain metaphysical principles of the universe. Yes, Tim?
When I was starting to read it, I was thinking really concretely about it. And as he would describe, like, as soon as he said universe and started, like, picking out places in the library, I started like the library is the universe, and then I said, okay, those hexagons are the galaxies, and then like I started trying to
make a one-for-one correspondence.
Yeah, and like I thought of the staircase as like a black hole in the center of a galaxy. And
excellent.
That's why it confused me a lot, because I couldn't really make.
So you see, this story is highly allegorical. We've already established that. And we were trying to make the allegory fit astronomical universe, but the allegory fits what other kind of universe is better? I mean, we've named several of them. The religious worldview, the kind of infinity of knowledge, the sense that you have as a librarian, as Professor Hall helped us think about, that there's just too many books for anybody to encompass. A linguist, wouldn't this be like a linguist, an allegory of the life of a linguist? Anything else he prophesizes besides the internet? Beside a world where the connections and links just go on forever?
He relates to basic human nature a lot, self-destructiveness, and also egotism too, you know, how prideful we are and how we think the books revolve around us. And I thought that was just how, you know, our common, you know, theories we wrote. I mean, based ourselves in this line, it's all very singularly based.
So an allegory of some of our human follies, our egotistical dreams. Yes, Greg.
Doesn't he almost kind of foresee postmodernism?
Yes, he does.
In that, like, people just like start not caring about who God is and not even trying to care who God was. Like, they just throw out the books that don't mean anything.
Borges is sometimes talked about in terms as a modernist, as a late modernist, but more often he's talked about as a early postmodernist, as a person that really began to create some of the fundamental strategies and ideas of postmodernism well before their time, back in the 41 for this short story.
He's kind of warning us against trying too hard to gain knowledge, like warning us against the thirst for knowledge a little bit, because like he mentions at one point, I don't remember where, that like some of the inquisitors or some of the searchers were driven mad when they were trying to find their own vindication books and stuff. So
the mad quester is a fairly prominent motif in world literature. Yes.
Doesn't he also say that? Where is he trying to find it? But like there must be one book that says it all. He just prays and hopes that one day, like even if it was thousands of years ago, that some person had read that book and had had all the knowledge.
That's a very powerful moment. Is there such a book? Matt's saying no.
Well,
why not?
Say by the law of the library, there has to be.
Yeah, some would say religion. Could be that book.
Well, the person that read it
would be Jesus.
Or God.
He compares to like the librarian who, like,
who would know that to God.
Yeah.
That's right. I mean, I thought of the genetic code, which of course he couldn't possibly have known about. But the notion of junk DNA, letters, just random letters, a code that is virtually infinite. And he didn't know about that. He certainly did not intend it. Yet this is, very interestingly, an allegory of how the genetic code works, too. How is that possible?
The shape's almost similar, too.
The spiral staircase? You know, when did the spiral shape of DNA, when was that first published? 1953, April 21, I do believe. But don't quote me over the podcast on the exact date in April or May, 1953. So he couldn't have known that. But how does it serve as an allegory of things he couldn't have known about, such as the way the interconnections of the World Wide Web seem to form a kind of infinite universe, or the way DNA works in infinite recombinations? Yes.
Oh. It seems like the cyclical order that he talks about not only seeming to pertain within each allegory, but from allegory to allegory. There's a cyclical order from DNA to internet to knowledge. Everything follows the same pattern.
That's very interesting. So,
and even stuff that
other comments along that line or any other line in answer to that question. Yes,
I guess his ad infinitum setup is. Pretty good setup for anything that seems infinitesimal.
Wesley, yeah, for saying very interesting things. Yes.
I was gonna support that because, again, back to the picture and the way he describes it, how the staircases go up to the next hexagon, and like how he says like they're each allegories and they're connected. So, structurally. Make sense too.
So the one way he could have been a prophet of all these different modes are that they all seem to function the same way, that any infinite or apparently infinite pattern will raise some of the same thoughts, some of the same doubts, some of the same questions, and provoke some of the same responses, like questing to learn more about them. That's why I thought this story was an interesting thing to read in relation to virtual worlds. It gave us an allegory of a virtual world. Shall we stop there? Is that enough, or do people have other things they want to say about it?
It's April 25th.
April 25th, 1953.
Hey,
I was close.
That's pretty good.
But wait, close only counts in horseshoes.
And hand grenades.
Oh.
And atomic bombs.
And nuclear weapons.
Okay.
That's why you're kids.
What about horseshoes? Let the podcast note April 25th is the actual date. Okay, well, let's stop there and turn our attention to characterization.
Matt, before we leave, I've got to ask one question, more base level. Who really liked the story?
Liked it.
You had an enjoyable experience as you went through it.
For the first half.
Let's see these actual hands.
Wait,
so
put them up high, guys. Come on. Don't sit on a fence.
I'm on a fence.
Oh, Ito's on a fence. Come on, Peaches.
Well, if you guys are on the fence, you raise your hand, you put it down.
So it's indicate Chris is rather washed.
So what are we saying about half the class like the story? And then how half the class...
I liked half the story.
Yeah.
That's where,
half
is
the
that,
class
is
liked
on the
half
fence?
The story.
I mean, is it... Why, like what makes you on the fence, Peter?
I think I was too tired when I read it.
That's what I was...
Because I put off my Lotro till yesterday. So I was playing, and then reading this was a little overkill for my mind.
So, lesson from that?
Don't
read Borges when you're tired. Could be another lesson.
Play more video games.
So, Professor Hall, you have a point you want to make about pleasure.
Well, I'm actually in Peter's situation here. I read this late last night after I finished a little cooking on Bumbleberry, and I'm very confident that it was my sleepiness that hampered my enjoyment of it. But I think when you experience something like this, it required you to really actually engage yourself in the work, and trying to do it casually didn't work at all for me. So I think I would have probably enjoyed it more, particularly in light of your conversation today, had I taken a little bit more pains to read it. But my initial reaction was, my God, I've got to get through this. And it was because of my sleepiness. And I just didn't know if anybody shared in that particular situation or not.
I actually read it in the morning in between classes. I had like an hour break and I read it. And I was like, I don't know, I had to wake up for an 8:10 class. So I was like,
I found myself rebooting paragraphs sometimes too.
Like one of my eyes would shut and you know, keep reading lines and then I'd snap out of it.
Okay, let's talk about character.
Uh-huh.
Let's add a category right here and to our diagram and talk about the role of or how characters are created. And let's begin with film. I mean, we have our three media here, online games, film, and books. Should be able to remember books. I'm an English professor. Let's start with character in film. I wanted to show you some of the basic techniques that film uses to help you identify with character. How do you think you identify with a character in a movie?
Facial expression.
Facial expression.
Body language.
Mm-hmm.
The same way you identify with someone. Really
okay, so if there's a character...
Good music or bad music?
If there's an actor you don't think you look like, how do you identify with that character?
Negatively. How they move, yeah, different things that they do.
Uh-huh. Personality
so,
traits.
So give me a male actor that you identify with. You know, one of your favorites.
Oh, gosh.
Brad Pitt?
Brad Pitt. Okay. So we've got Brad Pitt here. So what happens if he's watching a movie with Woody Allen as the star? How does... we won't even identify who it is that sees himself as Brad Pitt. How does...
I think you could guess.
How does this Brad Pitt identifying human being take pleasure in a movie that stars Woody Allen? What's the mechanism? How does a movie solicit sympathy?
Take pleasure in or identify with the character?
Okay, you're saying that you don't have to identify with the character to take pleasure in the movie?
No.
Okay.
Just like you don't have to be exactly like
that character's funny. It'll help to strengthen comedy, definitely. Like if he has subliminal. I mean, it doesn't have to be like straight up in your face comedy, but like if he does funny things, like you'll.
If the character stands out from anyone else, like if he's got different traits that allow, like you can see him different than everyone else.
Right. Like Danny DeVito.
Right.
Movies like that, which twins that had Arnold Schwarzenegger and Danny DeVito. How did you decide which to identify with there?
You look for yourself in other actors.
Yeah.
Do you?
Yeah.
Do you?
I can't see myself in either.
It's you.
Or you try to find truths that correlate yourself between in the actor, and that's naturally the one that you're going to find yourself pulled to.
So let me ask you a different question. We've got all these interesting theories of how we identify with character in movie. Let me ask you, you want to add to our theories? Yes.
Yeah, I think you identify with the star of the movie because you are the star in your own life.
That's very important, I think, particularly your use of the word star, because the movies, as a medium, have relied on the star system for the content of the movies often, not just for the sales. Of course it works in terms of promoting a movie and selling a movie, but also it became so powerful that it rapidly that was understood to be an aspect of the cinema, the film director's bag of tools, to use a star to solicit certain kinds of identification and not other kinds. And when stars tried to play against type, it often wouldn't work. Yes.
Yeah, I definitely identify a character in a movie with characters that he's played in previous movies.
That's like, isn't that interesting?
Like, I don't know his name, the guy who plays Snape.
Right. Oh, also is in Die Hard 1.
Yeah, he's in so many.
Alan Rickman, Die
Alan
Hard 1.
Agent Smith.
Yes.
I can't get that out of my mind. Yeah.
Elrond with Agent Smith. Mr. Smith. Exactly. Again, let me give you a word for that that Wesley has identified. Intertextuality. That's the word that people use for that phenomenon. You might think about that term there. It's the phenomenon where you're a character or scene or any really aspect of a work of literature or of a movie has as an important reference something outside of the text. So that, you're watching Snape and you're seeing Alan Rickman, who's reminding you of the villain of Die Hard. Or Elrond is being interfered with by Mr. Smith from The Matrix. Humphrey Bogart was a person that really illustrated this. From movie to movie, the references from one character to another was part of what made the fabric of the movie. So again, film exploited this from its early days and recognized it as one of the features. Of course, intertextuality occurs in every media, but film has it with a special power, I think. How do you know who the hero or protagonist of the movie is? At the very beginning, the title comes up, and then how do you know who you're supposed to identify with as the protagonist?
Starring
first name.
Well, nowadays they put the credits at the end.
Well, they have some beginning credits.
Usually, a lot of times it's one of the first people you see.
Mm-hmm.
Like Rush Hour 3. They
zooms
it right into Chris Tucker singing Prince.
I love it. Rush Hour 3, yes.
I was going to say that you can't always tell right away.
Uh-huh.
You always have to wait for the storyline to develop.
Are there any things that directors do, any gestures or camera work that you particularly associate with identifying the protagonist? Or another way to put it is, how does a movie establish point of view? You know how a novel establishes point of view. You've been taught that in your high school classes. How does a movie establish point of view? Mike, you had your hand up, I think, for some other point.
Well, I was going to say, how do you know who the good guy is? Mm-hmm. Sometimes, you'll see them doing something, and then you can tell they're going to be good. That's a good way to introduce whether someone's a good or a bad guy. Is the first scene, they do something good or bad. And I think that happens in a lot of movies. And sometimes it can be something really subtle, just like the lighting on a character can let you know whether he's going to be good or bad.
Well, Jeffrey said the music.
The music and the lighting are undoubtedly contributors to this.
Let me make an observation on this, Jay. In Star Trek, there was always, the original in particular, an associative theme tune with the villains and with the characters.
That's right.
Very strongly associated.
Well, then even in Star Wars, you get the
Imperial March with Darth Vader. Right.
There's also a particular set of camera strategies that film critics, yes, Matt?
They do a lot of behind the back. Like
exactly.
They look over so that you can see through the eyes of your main character.
That's exactly the gesture I'm getting ready to demonstrate. And the film theorists call this shot reverse shot. Shot slash reverse shot. And maybe we'll just put it up on our notes. But the iconic shot reverse shot camera move establishes for you right away the point of view of at least the scene, if not of the entire movie. Now, I'm going to show you an opening clip from the movie Goodfellas. Anybody seen that movie? How many have not seen it? A few people have missed out on that aspect of American culture. It's a gangster movie. It's a mafia, a mob movie. And the opening, it's directed by Martin Scorsese, one of the great directors of our time. Let's maintain our intention here. It's directed by Martin Scorsese, and just the opening scene of it demonstrates shot, reverse shot, establishing a point of view in a very powerful way, particularly because it's correlated with a first-person voice-over narration that establishes the film as an autobiography. So that more than your usual film, this opening sequence is all about soliciting the viewer's identification. So watch this opening scene and pay attention to where the camera is positioned in relation to the eyes of the character. Oops, I've got to go. VCR control.
That's not Goodfellas.
That's not Goodfellas? Oh, perhaps that's daytime television.
As the world comes.
So you're seeing outside at his eye.
To me, being a gangster was better than being president of the United States. Even before I first wandered into the cab stand for an after-school job, I knew I wanted to be a part of them. It was there that I knew that I belonged. And to me, it meant being somebody in a neighborhood that was full of nobodies. They weren't like anybody else. I mean, they did whatever they wanted. They double parked in front of a...
Go ahead, Matt. You explain it.
The second most famous one is called the first-person pan, where you actually, it's like a first person, and then it pans around. So then that when it backs up, then you just know what's going on, because you know that's your main character.
Did you understand what Matt just said about the first-person pan, or would you explain that again? Did we just see that?
Yeah.
That's what I wanted you to notice. So let's go backwards and watch it again. The first-person pan. So
this is from his eyes.
So you're seeing this scene.
That's how you may believe this. And then as it pans back to the character and then goes back from his head.
To me, it meant being somebody in the neighborhood that was full.
So then they'll go behind his head and then you have yours.
Oh, so they show up from his view and then they focus back on...
Exactly.
So then you're instantly identifying yourself because you're seeing the exact same thing that he is. So then when you see his face, you're like, oh man, that could have been me.
You're seeing what he's seeing, then you see him seeing it. Then the camera does the first-person pan, comes around to the back of his head, and you then will see through the window again. So the Scorsese is using every trick in the book to set up, in the very opening scene, whose point of view we should identify with. Yes, Ted.
Also,
I pointed to Jonathan. Go ahead, Ted.
Also, like, what he's saying, too, like, hearing him speak his mind, but like you don't see his lips moving, so you know that's what he's thinking. So
very
like
nice.
You're thinking like, okay, well this is what he's thinking. So like, you know, maybe I want to be a gangster too. You know?
So interior speech through voiceover is the equivalent of something in novels that we see all the time, which is interior monologue.
The omniscient narrator.
The novel has, we'll talk about it later, all the techniques the novel has for showing the thoughts of a character. But novels have developed and have the ability to spend a lot more time inside the mind of a character than a film does. In fact, it's rare when you get a character's thoughts reported directly as words in a film. And that's one reason this scene is so useful. Yes.
Da Vinci Code, they did a terrible job of it.
And a terrible job of it. Jonathan, you had something to say.
I was going
to
mention narration, how it also helps you identify who the main character is.
That's right. Okay, let's continue through here.
The elves, I mean, they did whatever they wanted. They double parked in front of a hydrant, and nobody ever gave them a ticket. In the summer, when they played cards all night, nobody ever called the cops.
What is his voiceover about?
Gangsters.
Gangsters.
Why he wants to be a gangster.
Will's got it. Say it again.
His view of the gangsters.
His view of the gangsters, which is what?
Very
positive. Does he see them as role models?
Yeah.
So not only is this scene showing, enacting cinematic identification for you, but his thoughts are about identifying with people outside him as role models. Yes.
The line that we actually just heard, like, I think he's trying to, like, confirm his feelings towards gangsters being good, because, like, no one thinks, oh, like, gangsters, oh, they're, like, you know, angels. Like, people think of gangsters as bad people, and he's trying to confirm his own opinion by saying, oh, well, they get play cards, but they don't get arrested.
And that's exactly right, and it's the problem that the whole movie is confronting, which is that you begin to identify very strongly with this character who is doing increasingly unsavory things. And so it's about the problem of taking as a role model something that is utterly unacceptable. Yes?
We're saying identify. It sort of sounds like we're saying, like, you think that you're like him, like you're seeing mm-hmm. yourself in him, but I'm sort of seeing it's sort of like he's your friend, because he's telling you all these things about himself, about, you know, how he thinks about gangsters and what he wanted to be and things. And so everyone else in this movie, you don't know anything about them, and you know things about him. So he's sort of like the most, you know the most about him. So he's the friend you have in this movie, sort of thing, as opposed to him being like you. He's someone that you know. I don't know. That is one.
Right. I think you have done a pretty good job, and you've helped us understand that identify with a character does not necessarily mean be like the character, or even wish you were like the character, but rather it means something else. Be able to take narrative pleasure in that character's story, sympathize with the character, and understand events from his or her point of view, even when the character's doing something that you wouldn't want to do. I mean, haven't you ever found yourself watching an action film or a war film and find yourself really identifying with the wrong side, and the movie is asking you to do that intentionally? Or a better example would be like a movie like Letters from Iwo Jima, which is not there identifying with the wrong side. How many have seen that movie? Well, I'll stop right there with that with that example, since no one's seen it. So I think that this is a great scene. We could keep watching it, but I think you've gotten the point about it. Let me change focus here and talk about some of the techniques that filmmakers use to solicit identification. So a filmmaker makes a movie, and the camera obviously is filming. Let's see, I'd like to just draw a line, so if I wanted to do it, you know, camera's focusing on the actors, taking the pictures of the actors. When the camera, when the film reaches you in the theater, the projector is projecting image of the actors onto that screen. The challenge for a movie maker is to solicit your identification with these figures up on the screen. Let's add a figure up on the screen here. That's Cary Grant. Here is Grace Kelly.
Being an artist.
It's pretty dramatic, isn't it?
It's never ending.
So,
it's a category.
The technique, the method of
can't compete with Goodfellas.
Goodfellas. How does the filmmaker get you to suture your identification, which is with one of these characters, into this relationship on the screen? Point of view of the camera, this relationship, and yet you're seeing it up there, and your point of view is here watching the image. General puzzle.
What are you asking?
I'm not sure we understand the question.
Yeah, I see. How do you get, when you watch a movie, do you feel like you're inside the action?
In mediation.
What?
Surround sound.
It's surround sound. It can certainly depend on the movie. I understand that. But you're out here, you're aware of yourself being a spectator, yet you're simultaneously being asked to identify with what's on the screen. And what's on the screen is being controlled by the point of view established earlier through the filming of the scene. So there is a spectatorial movement that's being asked for when you watch a film, to imagine yourself in the roles or in the position of, not that you literally imagine that you are Cary Grant kissing Grace Kelly, but that you have given your sympathy, your engagement with that narrative situation for the 2 hours or the hour and a half of the movie. That movie was probably closer to an hour and a half. So how does it do that? It's a film, or before? Yes, you've got a speculation.
I understand the question now, but I don't know the answer.
Okay, we'll rest there. Before we try to develop an answer, let's just be happy that we're aware that there's a problem in the first place, or not a problem, but something fairly sophisticated has occurred to enable you both to identify and be aware of who you are in your seat watching the movie, and to be sympathetically identifying with the figures up on a screen in front of you.
Are you talking about the willing suspense of disbelief?
Well, that's a great line, which of course...
No one knows what it means, but...
What do you mean no one knows what that means?
For some reason, we can feel the same thing that the characters that are going through feel.
The willing suspension of disbelief, the great quotation by... the great quotation by what 19th century poet has he just referenced?
I should know this.
Do you know?
Samuel Taylor Coleridge's comment that that's what fiction asks for, which is the willing suspension of disbelief. It's a thank you for introducing that into our discussion. What I am asking you about is how does the willing suspension of disbelief that you have to give to a novel to believe in the fictional world and the actions of the characters differ from the willing suspension of disbelief that you have to give to characters on a screen? That's the problem that I want you to think about. Don't rush to answer.
Can you say it again?
How do the mental activities you have to go through to suspend disbelief in a fictional world that is created by reading words on a page differ from the suspension of disbelief you have to go through to identify with projected characters on a screen? And are there any differences, any significant differences? Leslie, then you...
I think it takes a lot more will to suspend your disbelief whenever you're reading.
Why?
Because you have to create it all yourself, whereas when you're watching it on a screen, it's created for you. You have to be willing to suspend your disbelief, but it's not as hard. It's a lot hard. It takes concentrated effort to create this world whenever you're reading in a novel, whereas it's most of the work is done for you whenever you're watching a film.
I was going to say the exact opposite thing.
Okay. Please do.
Whenever you're looking on a film, it is created for you, but you already see the characters there, so you can't picture yourself at... you can picture yourself, but it takes more work for you to picture yourself as one of the people on the screen if you don't look like, you know...
Cary Grant. Or if you are a woman and you're trying to identify with the protagonist, Cary Grant, rather than the object of desire, Grace Kelly... that can be a problem. Seth, what was your view? And I'm going to come back to you.
Exactly what Wesley said, but you're saying movies have sight and sound.
Yeah.
So that you're kind of less involved. Everything's done for you, and so you don't have to worry about stuff. Books are just straight text, and it takes more thinking, I think.
It takes more imagination.
It kind of puts you more into that.
So we're getting two diametrically opposed views articulated. One is that books, because they require you to use your imagination at great, are harder to identify with. And the opposite position is that movies, because they give you a specific, rather finite image to identify with, are more difficult. I don't know who had their hand up, but we'll go with you, Peter.
I think with books, it really depends on the language used. I think books don't really require thinking to read. It's just unless you're not familiar with the vocabulary. So with the Library of Babel, when you're reading it, you're sort of in it, but you also sort of have to be thinking about what he's saying. With certain books, though, you're reading it and you understand all the words, so you just sort of like scan a paragraph, and I don't have to think, okay, so what does a tree look like? Okay, here's a tree. So there's a hobbit under the tree. Could I be that hobbit? No, you don't do that. You're just like, Frodo was under the tree. There's a tree, there's Frodo, or you're Frodo, or whatever. Your mind just does it. It just constructs it. And yes, the movies, it's already done for you, but I think your mind already does it for you, too, as long as it's a certain level of...
a compromised position.
Yeah, when you're reading, you make your own interpretation of the setting and everything, so you basically believe, and you're more... like, you believe more of what you create, as opposed to what the movie producers create. So it's easier to suspend your disbelief when you're reading a novel.
Yeah.
That's exactly what I was going to say. It's easier to find truth when you create it.
Let's watch... let's watch a little of the Lord of the Rings. And what's the best character in the movie Lord of the Rings?
Pippin.
Aragorn.
Legolas.
The best character.
In the trilogy.
Aragorn.
Legolas.
Gandalf picks the most best, but Legolas is the coolest.
In what respect?
I mean, are we just talking about raw butt-kicking power? Or are we talking about,
elephant's trunk?
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, my goodness. Surfing down an elephant's trunk.
I like that one.
Which character got the most praise from the reviewers?
Smeagol.
Smeagol did. By far. Smeagol going dead.
Everyone was talking about Smeagol afterwards.
Yeah.
Pardon me?
I remember when the movie first came out, everyone was like, my precious.
Yes.
That was awesome.
That's a catchphrase.
Now, whether he's the best character or not is irrelevant. I want us to focus on him because he is a very distinctive character. In fact, he's two characters, or he is also both an actor and a CGI creation, so that he is clearly a film image for us, but he's also a digital construction that is working both off of an actor that you know was in there somewhere and digital graphics, which moves him part of the way toward being the kind of digital creature we interact with in Lord of the Rings Online. So let's just look at the mechanism for characterizing this creature. In the first book, of course, in the first movie, rather, you don't get a lot about Gollum. In the second movie, he had that amazing fight with himself that was so praised that the very beginning of the third movie starts with finding the ring, Smeagol's finding the ring, which is not something that appears in the Tolkien trilogy, but it does appear elsewhere in Tolkien's work. But a flashback to it, Smeagol actually acquiring the ring doesn't appear in this format in the trilogy itself. And the filmmakers begin with this scene, no doubt because of the extraordinary reaction to Gollum Smeagol's role in film number two. And this has gone past Smeagol, so we're going to have to go back quite a way. It was clearly playing while I was...
Did you ever see the making of how they did Smeagol?
Oh yes.
That was really
cool. You want to tell the class about how they did Smeagol?
Well, they had the actual actor, and they put him in with a black suit on that has the light things on it that the computer picks up, and he would act out either on a green screen or and whenever he was in he actually went to the stream and almost got hypothermia because he was like wallowing in the stream, and they would record his movements. And they would use that as the basis for the CGI. So it's all done by a person. It's just enhanced by a computer.
And wasn't he a Cirque du Soleil acrobat?
Oh, that's why
he does all that crazy stuff.
He is. It was like this thing.
Okay, here we go. Lord of the Rings credit. What does that scene establish for you? That he's creepy? Where's the camera positioned? Are you behind his eyes?
Not yet.
You're behind the worm's eyes.
Yeah,
that he is looking at it almost as if he's going to pop it in his mouth. Is the filmmaker asking you to identify with Smeagol in this scene?
No, not yet.
Not yet.
Maybe the worm.
Maybe. Yeah, the worm.
The monster.
This is an extended scene from the theatrical release. It's very violent, can be upsetting. What is this scene? Yeah, but what does this scene establish for you or make you think of?
When he catches the fish later on.
I think it's cartoonish.
It is cartoonish. Which cartoon do you have in mind?
Well, just Looney Tunes.
Oh, okay.
Whatever the fish yanks him into the water.
Fish yanks him into the water, tows him along behind.
Is that the cartoon with the frog? Or is the cartoon with the frog where that happened?
Well, I was thinking of the Disney Merlin
Sword in the Stone
cartoon.
Yeah. Yeah.
But what it really does is it establishes a fairy tale atmosphere here.